And we will open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 960.
It would be on the ballot this second anyway. So I know.
Somebody wanted to go to trial.
I don't care.
Bruce Bishop and Pat Hearn. How's that? Sure, come on up.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm an attorney with Harang Long Gary Rudnick in our Salem office. I'm a registered lobbyist, and I'm both a member of the board of directors of the Capital Club, and I'm serving this year as the Capital Club's legislative committee chair. We appreciate your hearing Senate Bill 960, which is our proposal for improving the reporting and registration requirements that apply to lobbyists in Oregon. When I prepared my testimony, I understood that we had about 300 lobbyists in the Capital Club. I've been advised this afternoon by Ed Patterson that we're closer to 400 members of the Capital Club who are lobbying. What our bill attempts to do is to clarify and simplify the registration and reporting requirements we abide by as lobbyists in Oregon. There are some housekeeping editorial changes that have been made in the bill to clarify existing language in the statutes. Legislative Council has taken out some thereofs and other language that they think is confusing. But there are also some substantive changes that we'd like to bring to the committee's attention. In current law, there are provisions that refer to lobbyists who are employed, and that does not necessarily encompass the range of lobbyists who practice. Some of us are contract lobbyists, and consequently, I'm not technically employed by the clients that we represent. So in this bill, we've tried to modernize the language so that it refers to employed or who appears on behalf of the client. We've also addressed and tried to clarify the provisions concerning uncompensated lobbyists. Under current law, it says a lobbyist who receives no other compensation for lobbying, but it doesn't describe what other compensation means. And so we've attempted to clarify those provisions in the law to provide specific standards about when a lobbyist is required to register with the Government Standards and Practices Commission and consequently report thereafter lobbying expenditures. The bill also includes a specific definition of compensation taken from existing law, which means that compensation includes wages or salary. We have expanded in Section 4 of the bill the registration requirements to include additional information that would be helpful in the registration. Items like telephone numbers, other specific information about lobbyists. We have also included there a provision about whether or not the lobbyist is a member of the Capital Club. Probably about a third of the registered in the state are Capital Club members, but we see this as a way of facilitating coordination between the Government Standards and Practices Commission and the Capital Club. The bill will require that lobbyist registration for new clients or new interests be filed with the GSPC within 3 days of lobbying on such a client's behalf. The current statute is ambiguous for new clients after the initial registration has been received about what a lobbyist's obligation to register is, and we will, in the bill will specify the requirement to register for new interests. Importantly, for a number of lobbying organizations in the state, the bill will simplify the reporting requirements and registration requirements for lobbying firms. Under the current law, if you have more than one lobbyist in the same firm representing the same clients, the client has to file a separate registration for each individual. And this will allow for multiple registrations for all of the members. They still have to be identified individually as to who the lobbyists are, but the client doesn't have to repeatedly sign multiple forms for each individual within the organization that's lobbying. The bill will remove the requirement that lobbyists' registrations terminate every 2 years. That was a provision that was added several years ago when the commission was seeking to assess fees against lobbyists, a provision that was subsequently struck as being unconstitutional, but the two-year renewal requirement has remained in the law, and we are replacing that because it's become difficult for lobbyists, I think, and perhaps for the commission as well, to keep track of registration renewals on a two-year cycle. There's no particular value that we're aware of having that two-year requirement. So that would be removed, but in its place we would add a specific requirement that lobbyists notify the commission when their registrations terminate. So we would fully expect that, and the commission would be able to enforce that when a relationship has terminated, the lobbyist has an affirmative obligation to notify the commission so that that registration is no longer on the books. The bill will repeal the provision that would allow the commission to basically collect a fee from lobbyists as part of the registration process. It would allow lobbyist expenditure reports to be submitted by an entity. So just as with the registration requirements where a firm could submit a form identifying all these individuals, similarly, the reporting requirements for lobbying expenditures could be consolidated, and the same information would not have to be repeated for each individual within that lobbying firm. And finally, it would clarify that the prohibition on a lobbyist, on a public official lobbying would on lobbying by a public official would only apply to lobbying in Oregon. So a public official who wished to lobby in some other jurisdiction would not be technically in violation of Oregon law by attempting to do so. In sum, those are the proposals that the Capital Club has identified for your consideration. We think that there are probably a few tweaks in the language that could be made in the bill, but by and large, it adequately addresses the issues that we were concerned about, and we believe will overall simplify the process, both for lobbyists and for the Government Standards and Practices Commission in lobbying regulation. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Anybody still awake? Senator Atkinson. Well, if I found one, that's pretty good.
I have that effect on people, Mr. Chair.
Where is it on here that it's part of the new form or the new amendment that says how much debt you have?
I don't believe that's a requirement of lobbying
Sure.
registration or reporting.
What about real property?
I'll give them a follow-up.
Lobbyists are not required, in my experience, to report that on the registration or reporting.
Boa, about 20% of where you get your income.
That's not a requirement for lobbyists to disclose on their registration or reporting forms.
Boa, certainly.
What about companies that you work for that also employ public officials? Why don't you list what public officials are employed by the same organization or same company that you represent for a brief period of time?
I believe there is a requirement that lobbyists disclose any public officials who are in their firm or work with them, and Mr. Hearn may remember more specifically those provisions.
Follow up? You ever been falsely accused of doing anything? Have you ever had your integrity impugned falsely as a result of filling out this form?
Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, no, I have not had that experience personally.
Discussion? Here, a professional lobby organization is putting together a streamlining of the form and requirement for their standards and practices. We don't do that. We don't do that for us, for members of the legislature. We report, correct me if I'm wrong, 20% of our income comes from debt, real property, whether or not we shared business with the lobbyists. A whole range of things that I personally think are, I don't know, sharing business with the lobbyists, but things that I think are kind of private, personally. And I realize there's a difference of opinion on all that, but we don't streamline this form for us as a legislative branch because we're too busy. But yet, I think the deadline is next for our little 15. Statement is
Monday.
Monday. At 5 by certified mail or hand delivered.
Regular mail works, doesn't it?
No. Mm-hmm. Certified.
It's suggested that you certified.
Suggested.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering why we're going through the exercise of making sure that, and I appreciate this, I'm not, I mean, take, it's just a point I'm making, but we're taking all this time to go through and make sure all this is cleaned out, but we're not doing it for ourselves. We're not making it any easier for ourselves, and we're reporting on things that I personally find offensive, like debt. Why is debt public record? Why is real property public record for public officials?
Let's just have to do this bill.
What about that? What about that, Mr. Chair?
It's got everything to do with this bill.
I got a stack this big of bills you've gotten stuff.
I know.
He wanted to say something.
That's okay.
He felt an urge.
I felt an urge.
A need.
Okay, that's it.
Last time I did that, I got in Steve Dean's column. It wasn't very
I'll
good.
Stay quiet for another month.
He's talking about you again this morning.
You know, you got to go back to sleep.
No, you be quiet. You just lay off of us.
You said the guy was boring. I never would have said that because of his feelings. It's Easter coming up, buddy.
I didn't say he was boring.
What you said, anybody awake?
Doesn't necessarily mean it's Monday. I mean, it could mean we're working hard and we're tired. It's late in the day.
You said it to me. I've been taking personally.
You're the one who called him boring, not me.
Well, I didn't call him boring, but I was trying to check for his feelings, see if he needs therapy as a result of the statement you made. Is anybody awake?
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, I'm Senator Miller. Can you answer this conversation?
I see you've done a little fixing, I think, in this area, but that I still have that language in there about the 24 hours and a calendar quarter and $100 calendar quarter. That is just so puny. Did you take a look at doubling that? Maybe that's not of any concern to you. It usually catches the person who's rather casual at this, but it's not hard to do 24 hours and $200.
In terms of cap of club members, I think we are all easily over the threshold, so we did not address that specifically. I believe those provisions are for the intermittent lobbyists who may be here periodically, and the cleanups that we proposed in that section, specifically in Section 3, were that it was very difficult to understand when you were required to register under those circumstances, when you're only here occasionally, how to apply the 24-hour, $100 expenditure limitation. The one area I believe where that issue does affect Capital Club members has to do with subsequent client interest and whether the 24-hour, $100 expenditure thresholds apply just to the lobbyists. For the first time I exceed those thresholds, I register, or if it applies to each client for whom I may serve. And I believe it's the commission's understanding of the law that it applies to the individual lobbyist. Once I, as a lobbyist, have exceeded either of those thresholds and registered, I'm then required to register immediately for any new client interest, and I can't apply either the 24-hour or the $100 thresholds to new client interests thereafter.
Yep.
All up there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought a person who hires you for, could be more than 24 hours and $100. They show up as, what, I guess you're a client?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, that's correct. They would have to sign the authorization to lobby. I signed as a lobbyist and signed as official and authorized me to lobby on their behalf.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anything else? Pat?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Senators. I think many of the things Mr. Bishop has stated about Senate Bill 960 are too inaccurate, especially the removal of archaic language and replacing it with more contemporary words. I think it sure makes it easier to understand for a lot of us. And there are probably some editorial cleanup type things that can be done. And I think in many areas we can probably fairly easily reach an agreement. There are four specific points that I prepared in advance for this afternoon that I did want to bring to your attention. Now, the first one is not something that's in Senate Bill 960, but in reading some of the proposed amendments to Senate Bill 960, it caught my attention. And that is this, that current lobbying law and a provision of Senate Bill 960 talks about contacting members of the legislative assembly or the executive branch. In other words, lobbying legislators and executive officials as well.
Excuse me, Pat. What amendments?
I'm sorry. I don't mean amendments. I guess part of the bill is what I'm referring to.
We're scrambling here to find amendments.
Yeah, I apologize for my vernacular there. Refers to both members of the legislative assembly and the executive branch, but yet in the definition of lobbying, which is on page 1 of the bill at line 27, doesn't say anything about executive officials. Only talks about legislative officials. I think to make the law consistent that there should be an insertion of the term or executive officials following legislative officials there at line 28. As I said, it was this bill that caused me to notice this, and that's why I wanted to bring it to your attention.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Minnis.
Pat, the effect of that would be to include executive branch officials outside of the legislative assembly, I'm assuming, that are not currently covered for the purpose of lobbying?
It's for contact by lobbyists with Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, is for contact by lobbyists to those.
Right, but if I'm understanding correctly, help me if I'm not, but currently, those contacts are not covered at all.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that's correct.
So you would want to put those contacts in this bill? Huh. It's a substantial expansion of...
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, well, what's interesting is that there's several other places where executive branch or executive official, for instance, the definition of an executive official already exists in the statute on page 1, line 13 of the bill. It's already there, and it has been for some time. But yet that definition of the word executive official is virtually meaningless because contact with executive officials isn't covered by the definition of lobbying.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, Pat, isn't the assumption that the lobbying occurs at the legislature and that these definitions apply to those individuals who meet those definitions as it relates to their relationship to the legislative assembly as it's sitting, as opposed to the relationship that registered lobbies might have with executive department officials outside of the legislature that's then sitting?
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, I think that certainly is a perception, but it seems to me, in looking at the other usages relating to the executive branch in this chapter, that there must have been some kind of an intent or design that lobbying of executive officials also fall within under these restrictions.
I guess the difference is lobbying by executive branch officials as opposed to lobbying of.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, this does not refer in any way to lobbying by. It's only lobbying of.
I'm going to have to study this, puppy.
Okay.
The second point I wanted to bring up relates to language that's used to identify various parties in the lobbying process. For example, person is used in Senate Bill 90 to refer both to an individual human being and also an entity on whose behalf someone lobbies. Individual is also used to mean a human being. Entity is used in the bill to mean a lobbying firm. Seems to me to be confusing, and I would suggest the following, that the term person be used for someone who is not either a legislative official, an executive official, or a lobbyist, and that the term entity be used for the organization, company, or agency represented by a lobbyist, and finally, that the term lobbying firm for a business consisting of more than one lobbyist that represents clients for economic gain.
Okay.
The third point I wanted to bring out has already been mentioned by Mr. Bishop, and that is the proposal that the lobbyist registration form be modified to include whether or not a lobbyist is a member of the Capital Club. The Capital Club is a private entity. Members of the public, the media, and the Legislative Assembly virtually never inquire of our office as to whether or not a lobbyist belongs to the Capital Club. And it is difficult for me to see how this amendment would either strengthen disclosure requirements or be of other benefit. I think if somebody wanted to know whether or not a lobbyist was a member of the Capital Club, it would be natural for them to contact the Capital Club in an attempt to obtain that information. And a final point relates to the proposal.
Let me ask Bruce there, where does this come from? Who cares about this?
Mr. Chairman, the reason we included that was because, as you know, the Capital Club has a set of professional standards mm-hmm. that we enforce, just as the Government Standards and Practices Commission has some statutory standards that it uses to regulate lobbyists. We're both kind of in the same business, and it seemed like having a crosswalk so that if somebody inquired of the commission whether a person was a member of the Capital Club and whether, for example, a complaint with the Capital Club might be appropriate, the commission would be able to respond to that request directly. So it was in the nature of having information available to people that seemed like something that would be easy enough to disclose and would be helpful.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now, final point of concern is the proposal that a single registration statement be filed by lobbying entity that employs, I'm sorry, I lost a couple things when I printed this off, that a single registration statement be filed by a lobbying entity that employs more than one lobbyist. And the desire for them to be able to obtain this is understandable because it cuts down on the amount of paper that they have to handle and transmit. And I'm not saying that it is not workable, but I'm saying at this early point in the short life of this bill, I haven't yet been able to determine how we might do it. As an example, records of lobbyist and lobbyist entity registrations and expenditures are currently maintained individually under the name of the individual lobbyist or entity. That is the way the public requests information from us. It appears that this proposal could result in making it more difficult for persons to monitor individual lobbyists and the entities they represent. But as I indicate, Mr. Chair, with all sincerity, if we can figure out the logistics of it, it might be workable. It's just I can't get there yet.
Just a simple database that you could cross-reference, I would assume, would be pretty simple. Okay. All right.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I brought you examples of our current registration forms and expenditure forms. I wasn't sure how familiar you might be with those, and at least it would give you an idea as to what type of information is being requested right now.
Previously, you referenced the doing away with the re-registration as being an issue. Still an issue?
Yes, it is an issue, Mr. Chair.
Did I miss that?
prior to 1993, and this is notwithstanding the registration fee that has since been ruled unconstitutional by the Supreme Court. I mean, this is an issue whether there's a registration fee or not. But prior to 1993, there was no expiration or other kind of mandatory termination of lobbyist registrations. And at any given time, we would look at our records, and it would reveal that there were somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 1,300 active lobbyists. And what that meant was that every time there was a lobbyist report due, which is five times a biennium, we would prepare those report forms, we would mail them out to the lobbyist for whatever to whatever information was in our database. And many, of course, would not file. They were long gone. I mean, some of them had registered probably, you know, 10 or 12 years earlier. When the new law went into effect in 93, and there was that two-year automatic expiration, and those automatically expired for the first time, and then we went to the two-year, that 12 to 1,300 dropped to an average of about 600 at any given time. So the concern was that without a mandatory expiration, I mean, although, as Mr. Bishop indicated, you could require somebody to terminate in 30 days, we have experience that indicates people come to Oregon for the legislative session. They're here to lobby on a particular issue or two. The session ends, and they're gone someplace else. And they're not going to lobby here again, and they're not going to terminate. We see this every year just in the expenditure reports we mail in now that come back undeliverable with no forwarding address. Probably 20% of our lobbyist expenditure reports have to be remailed.
Can you purge your files on that undeliverable?
Yes.
You do?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We don't keep it in there, no, sir.
So you take them out?
Yes.
If the mail comes back?
Yes. If there's no place for it to go. I mean, we do make an attempt. We'll contact the entity they represented, perhaps, or someone to see if we can find a forwarding address. If we're unable to, then we purge it.
You don't like the 2 years. They don't like a cluttered file. How do you fix the problem?
Mr. Chair, one of the things that's occurred since the two-year registration requirement went into place is that the commission has the authority to levy civil penalties for expenditure reports that are not submitted on a timely basis, and the commission has started within the last year to assess civil penalties in the amount of $5 a day for delinquent reports. It seems to us that that's a sufficient enforcement mechanism. If somebody, you know, hasn't terminated their registration, then they are still a registered lobbyist. They have an obligation under the law to make expenditure reports. The commission can enforce that requirement. And the difficulty with the two-year registration requirement, particularly for lobbyists who have multiple clients, is that the two-year tracks from the time of the first registration. It's not on a January 1 biennium or any other fixed registration period. So if I file for one client on January 1st and another client on January 23rd, and if I have 10 clients that are scattered all over the place, these registrations are, you know, renewing 2 years on that basis. And frankly, you know, for some of us, we set up a system that tracks that and just submit them. It requires the client to sign them again, but, you know, so be it. For some other lobbyists, it's an obstacle. You forget about the registration. I think this happens particularly for lobbyists who are employed, you know, by an association or by an employer. You forget about it. You don't realize that your registration is last. And there's no reason to have a two-year termination.
Okay. Do you want some of this?
Well, I was...
Before we let them go?
I was stressing to find the problem. Hmm. And I came up with this idea, kind of. That
you found the problem.
If I understand this, you're sending out a lot of
forms to people who may or may not still be lobbying.
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, correct.
What if the person who was required to file something needed to apply for the form or needed to come get one, like a tax form, as opposed to you being so nice and generous and sending one out to the world, that we would expect that those who participate in this system and were required to send some statement to you just did so? You didn't have this requirement, or if it is a requirement, to contact everybody who's ever registered. Would that be helpful?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, I think it would greatly exacerbate the problem of noncompliance. There would be, we would virtually have no way to assure that those who were required to call for a form did in fact call for the form. And if they didn't, and if they had moved or whatever, I don't know how we'd track them down.
Is it feasible to go to a single date, 1st of January or something like that? Like, would that work?
Mr. Chair, I think it would. I mean, we'd have to think about when. For instance,
he's saying he's got to do 10 different dates, 10 different clients, let's all do the first quarter,
right,
or something like that.
Well, Mr. Chair, very honestly, that certainly is a problem that's easy to recognize, and many multi-client firms have themselves taken care of their registration so that they all expire at one time. I mean, they have done that. Maybe, for instance, when they had half their clients had expired, maybe the others weren't, but they went ahead and renewed them that one time early so that from then on they all expire at 2 years. And many have done that, and it seems to work effectively for them. But we could probably do something like July 1st or sometime that didn't conflict with other reports we have coming in, like expenditure reports and statements of economic interest, simply because our staffing is so limited.
Okay. Well, if you guys do me a favor, we got a couple of things that we might want to clean up between the two proponents or the two parties. Maybe you get together and let me know when you want to do this thing again. Would that work for you?
Sure. Thank you, Mr.
Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
If not, I've got a great bill here to gutting stuff, so I'd suggest you guys get on it. I might need this thing. All right, with that, we will close the public hearing on 960 and open the public hearing on Senator George's bill, which is Senate Bill 692.
Roll the tape.
So I can keep my bill, is that okay?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairman Harper. For the record, State Senator Gary George, District 2. And as many of you know, my name is Gary L. George, and the L does not stand for Lawrence. It stands for landslide. And so I have a personal interest in what line 6 of the bill says for the purposes of ensuring integrity in the election process. And as we saw this year in the presidential election, and as we saw in other elections throughout the state, many times it does get down to a very, very few votes. Now, I'm going to take you back in time to 1990, and I was involved in another very, very close election. In fact, was declared the winner of that election at that time, only to find out about 3 weeks later that, in fact, Tim Josie had won that race. And so what happened at that time in 1990, coming up until this year, was a recognition of that we might, in fact, have problems within the process. One of the things that we did this year as we were following your process was to look for things that we had seen as problems or iniquities, and then actually trying to see if there was any issues that you had not addressed. One of the things that we thought was important was, in fact, to videotape the process. Now, many of the bills that you're dealing with were ideas that we had, and we strongly support the idea of ensuring integrity in this election process. As we could tell, it undermined a presidential inauguration, and a lot of people indicating that they didn't respect the president. It turns out, in fact, that he is the president, and the process turned out to have functioned pretty well. But as you can see, one of the purposes, points I'd like to make today, and I'm not advocating the purchase of any product here, by the way, I'll do a disclaimer, but you can see today technology has caught up with our need. And as you can see, that you can buy three cameras for a super deal of $169.99, a savings of $89.99. Now, the point of that is this. The point of that is this, is that we have high-quality technology today that will ensure that we have a very accurate process, that it is recorded. And I'm going to tell you guys something. I don't know if you've ever seen those devices along a highway that are monitoring what's happening. And I don't know if you've ever been in a store and you'll see a camera, or in this building and there's a camera on. You guys, the senators, recognize we act differently when we know the camera's on. I think also it adds to the integrity of the process to know that everything that's happened there within any counting area, within the security of those ballots, that it would in fact be on tape. And so I think it's a good part of the whole process that you folks are undertaking, but did feel that was one of the parts that I believe was necessary, was to have some mechanism to actually record what was happening in relationship to the security and the counting of the ballots. Be happy to answer any questions. Boy, this was easy. I'm back to my committee.
I want to hear a little bit more about studded tires.
Oh, you do? All right. Am I being taken hostage? Can I have a camera on?
Senator George,
yes.
The term the videotaping, the tally of the ballots, does this mean whether they're running through the machine or whether they're being opened and the signatures verified?
Well, I think, as you can tell, if you guys have been on the net and looked at any of this new technology, this stuff is so inexpensive that literally, and here, of course, where you're talking about a mobile system that with wireless, it could be placed in any given position. And of course, we allowed the Secretary of State to adopt rules establishing the requirements. And I think each part of this, if I were running that office, I would want this tape machine. I think if I were doing it, I would go buy this equipment myself. I'm not advocating that for any of the county clerks, but I'm just saying is I think it's a great idea to have the ability to say, look, this is an open, fair, and secure process. So that's our concept behind that, ensuring the integrity of the election process. That's line six. I wish I'd written that. That's a really good statement.
And if you act today, you can save $89.99.
You certainly can.
Great.
Well, Senator, I'm just trying to envision that. The one that I've been in a few of them, watched them count them, but the one I'm most familiar with is Lane County's. And the nature of their facility is they're sort of stuck off in a number of different rooms depending on what they're doing. And I guess what you're proposing is that the whole place be videotaped.
Well, that would be ideal. Excuse me, Senator Harper and Senator Meyer. That would be my ideal desire. But we, as you can tell, we left this with discretion, for the Secretary of State and for county clerks to arrive at some reasonable conclusion. My thought being is that the maximum amount of scrutiny provides the maximum amount of integrity. Not to suggest in any way that any ballots have ever been miscounted. But I think the point today is there is a high level of suspicion that the system may be manipulated. And I'm going to be very honest with you. I'm not a black helicopter person, but I wondered about the 90 election. I really did. How this would turn around and be turned around this way. And we've seen other elections like that where election went from one position to another. It would have been a heartburn level reduced if, in fact, we would have had been able to look at tapes if necessary. And so... that's kind of our position.
In a minute.
Senator George, this bill is written such that it's mandated that counties do this. What would be the remedy if they didn't do it?
Well, I would suspect that would be something the Secretary of State would adopt. My thought being is that hopefully we would send money to accomplish some of the things that we will be recommending to the counties. I have not been following in great detail your process, but Senator Harper, Senator Minnis, I would hope that we would make funds available. My point being is that this is not a very expensive process to establish. And if nothing else, a pilot program.
I like pilot programs.
Yeah.
Senator Minnis.
The secure receptacle issue, can you tell us more about it?
Well, and that was language, obviously, that somebody wrote, and I think what that would mean is that the county clerk would be responsible for a secure method of maintaining the integrity of the tapes.
like maybe a garbage can with a lid on.
Maybe it could be, yeah. Well, I mean, seriously, we transported ballots and all kinds of things this year, and that's not a joke. I mean, it could end up being like that, but at least you would have a tape of maybe the guy putting the lid on the garbage can.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Brown.
I understand from your conversation that you're concerned about the integrity of the system in terms of the voting system. I'm just curious whether you would support creating the statewide voter registration database as well as getting rid of punch card ballots, which I think is really the issue in terms of trying to more accurately depict voters' intent.
Senator Harper, Senator Brown, answer yes, I would support that. But I was also concerned as we watched some of the ballots in which you take a pencil and you draw a line between the one end of your arrow and the other, and to recognize that when the people were going over some of the extra ballots, which was very important in my election, that literally they were sitting there with a pencil and an eraser. And to me, that's would be more reassuring to all candidates, to any registered parties or any other persons that press or whomever, that in fact that process wasn't in fact recorded.
Okay.
Thank you, guys.
George, we appreciate
back
that.
My committee.
Charles and Scott.
Charlie, you get into this and you have to get a union card.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Charles Stern. I'm the Yamhill County Clerk, and I'm the county clerk. We had a close race, as you just heard, in which we had observers watching our process. We don't mind being videotaped. I don't think that's even an issue with the clerks. Kind of the issue is, first, we weren't aware there was a big problem out there to solve, and then if there is, we're open to having the videotapes, so we're kind of wondering who's going to pay the price. The senator has presented you with some information from the Internet. I don't know if that camera will produce the kind of quality that you're going to use as evidence in court, because that is one of his desires in line 8 and 9 of this bill, is that this is going to be of a quality where it's admissible to court. I had our security come in and review where we count our ballots. And I said, what's it going to take to meet this standard? And they said that it would take a minimum of 2 cameras, a multiplexer, a recorder, and a monitor, based on their analysis of what they do for court security. So that's kind of the clerks, you know, who's paying the freight. And you heard the senator saying that you would be happy to do that, and we're pleased to hear that.
We get it today.
The check's in the mail. Yes. Before midnight, I think this thing said. The other thing was the time period this would go on. I was uncertain from the bill, and I'm still uncertain from listening to the senator's testimony, whether this was something that would be running to be sure nobody came in after hours and did something, or whether this is just during the period that we were counting the ballots. And that's kind of uncertain to me in this bill. Be happy to answer any questions.
You mentioned you'd be happy to be videotaped.
Yeah, I'll try to wear a tie.
Well, would it be correct now that it's when you have a recount and you have the observers come in, can they bring in a tape recorder and film the whole thing?
Mr. Chair, Senator Miller, we've never had that request, and I don't see
any reason why you couldn't have come.
It's just getting positioned so you have a adequate recording. You know, it's one thing to have a camera. It's another thing to have something when you get done, you know, a picture that shows sufficient detail.
I'm just saying if an observer wants to bring one, you have no problem.
I don't know of any rule why they couldn't. I don't know of any.
Okay.
Craig can bring his next time.
Chair Harper, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Scott Tai. I'm the operations manager for the Elections Division. Yeah. And I just wanted to bring up a couple points. As far as observers go, Our directive requires that the county clerks allow citizens to be observers for the entire voting process, and that would begin with the certification of the vote tally machines throughout the entire process to the very end on the final or post-certification of the vote tally machine. So that would include receiving ballots, verifying signatures, opening the ballots, removing the ballots, counting the ballots, and then the final certification. So we already have mechanisms in place for people to observe. If cameras help out or accentuate that, I don't know. We're not sure. That would be a policy decision. We also wondered about the scope of the tally of ballots, because are we just going to require videoing of the ballots as they run through the vote tally machine, or does this include the entire process from the certification of the vote tally machine to the receiving of all ballots throughout to the very end? We would ask that the legislature identify what is meant by tally of ballots, because it could include broadly that entire process, or narrowly just videoing ballots coming out of the vote tally machine, or it may be where we just abstract the votes, and one could call that a tally of ballots. Regarding the rule adoption, the way I read the bill, and maybe I'm not reading this correctly, but Section 2 does not, I don't see where Section 2, which requires the videotaping, allowing us any rulemaking authority to require the county clerks to video any portion of the tally of the ballots. However, Section 3 does allow us rulemaking authority to set up the security of the ballots, and we've already testified here before that based on our task force report, we intend to meet with the clerks and come up with new rules that would address the security of the ballots, both in storage, counting, and transporting ballots. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Anybody else on this thing, 692? Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 692.
You don't have it scheduled for work session.
And open up a work session on SJR 40. Maybe. Again.
Maybe.
Senator Beyer. They don't get too far away here.
We'll be right outside.
We need to talk.
Stop this issue.
We need to talk on this issue, Spring Bean.
What are you doing? 3 minute recess? We do?
They have a
first,
little recess, Spring Bean.
You can have a little recess.
Thank you.
We'll have a little recess.
Session on SJR 40. Mr. Chair, you want me to talk about?
No, just mend it.
No, I want you to. I want to hear about this thing. Yeah, you're going to get the guy who can answer the questions up here. Last committee meeting, we talked about having two measures in the same, two separate measures put in one bill that would allow, would be a referral to the public and would allow them to vote on a total repeal or just a restriction to 12 years. In essence, that's what the Dash 2s do. Ted worked it out, and it's hard to get there by looking at it, but that's what it does. Essentially, the first part of it, Section 19, is essentially the bill as the good senator from Klamath Falls has brought it to us. Paragraph 3 essentially goes through and takes the others out so that you have a total repeal.
Yeah,
that's all right. Can you find it in your
seat?
Yeah, I know you have problems with it.
Yeah.
When we finish with this explanation, I want you to point to me on the chart where we are.
I think we're in the first box.
Essentially, it does what we said. And the choice is, the question last time is, legally, can we put both of them on the ballot at the same time? And the answer is yes. And that's what the bill does. Directs the Secretary of State to put both of them on the ballot.
And we can do this.
Is that right? Ted, did I say that right?
Mr. Chair, Ted Reutlinger from the Legislative Council. That's basically an accurate description. This amendment allows the legislature to refer...
Apparently I didn't say it right.
No. There's just a point or two I'd like to add.
It took me sometimes through to understand what it said. But.
Basically, it all goes back to this Armada case, which interprets Article 17 of the Constitution, which says that amendments to the Constitution have to be voted upon separately by the people. So the reason that we think that you can refer two separate amendments in one resolution is that the Constitution doesn't say that you, the legislature, has to vote upon them separately. It says that the people have to vote upon them separately. So this contains two separate amendments to the Constitution, directs the Secretary of State in the referral clause to separate them out, place them on the ballot separately, place them on the ballot consecutively so that they can be voted upon separately to comply with Article 17 of the Constitution. As you know, there is at least one precedent for doing this, which was last session in HJR 7, the crime victims' rights measures, which were eventually split up and referred out independently. To my knowledge, the legislature has not ever referred two separate amendments in one resolution in this fashion, but we can't find anything in the Constitution that says that it's prohibited.
So we're making history today.
Just trying to get the box.
Yeah, we're going to add a box to this chart here.
This is historic.
I'm going to change the topic a little bit, Ted, and I have some questions for you. And it's regarding the House bill that expedites the filing date and the Supreme Court review. Did you draft that bill?
Yes, I did.
Okay. My question is this. Can you give me a rough approximation of how long it might take for someone to actually file, once the bill is passed, for someone to file and for the challenge to reach the Supreme Court? Can you give me a rough idea?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, I would hesitate to do that. I don't know how long it will take the circuit court to proceed. I think you could probably look at how long it took the Marion County Circuit Court to issue a decision in the Armada case. In the recent
measure 7?
Right, that's what I meant. In that case, to see how long it took them, Judge Lipscomb, to issue that decision, which will,
came down in February after a November election.
Right, we're probably looking at a similar timeline. That bill has an emergency clause, so if it becomes law, a member could file immediately.
We got the big gun.
Hey.
You need some help?
Greg, where are we on this chart?
He looks for this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I don't know where you are on the chart, but as you may recall, I prepared a swell booklet that explains all those little pictures for you. So if you need extra copies, we just got a new load in. Can I help?
Did you get your question answered, Senator Fran?
I did.
Well, then I'll leave.
No, wait.
No.
I want to know why we're doing it this way. What's the pluses?
If there's any risk, why take it?
What?
We can do it separately.
Well, if you want to do it separately, I think you come up with the same thing in the end. I mean, my personal goal was to be very clear with the public and say you've had this in effect with 10 years, there's been a lot of discussion by all kinds of people, and you have really three choices. One's a default choice, leave it alone the way it is. Two, repeal the whole thing. Or three, modify it to eliminate the service in houses and just totally keep it at 12 years.
So we failed in being clear to the public.
Disclosure. No, I don't think so. I think those are very separate choices.
Well,
there are a number
of
people on this committee, I think, who said that they would vote to do away with the whole thing, put it out there and give the public a chance of that and didn't want to mess with it. And there are others who said they'd be perfectly fine with 12 years.
But this is going to hit the street as two separate measures, correct? I mean, they're going
to
vote on...
They have to be separate.
They're not going to have that. I mean, that was a good idea, but that's not the way it's going to be. I mean, it can't be presented in that.
Well, absolutely. I think you can. It depends on how you write the statements and how you write the voter pamphlet.
No, okay.
Which we have a chance to do.
Mm-hmm. Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, just a comment in these ongoing conversations about this issue. And we talked last week about the likelihood or non-likelihood of our Supreme Court overturning term limits. And my question to the committee to ponder over the next few days is, why would we put something on a ballot November 2001 when, A, you would have to spend a lot of money to win, and B, you've got a legal challenge pending on the constitutionality of term limits? That is my question.
Okay. Senator Atkinson.
My question is, if we need to get a constitutional, I guess my first question is, don't we need, in order to have one of these things succeed, don't we need a constitutional, do we need a simple majority?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Atkinson, you mean to pass the measure by the people?
Three, or one of these two.
The legislature voting a simple majority or the people? Yes, just a simple majority.
My question is, are we not watering down the possibility of getting that simple majority by having two essentially competing measures out there, numerically speaking? I mean, it's going to be easier for a group to say, just vote no on both of them. That's a pretty easy campaign to run. For Oregonians to say, you know, to actually look at it and try to make a solid decision whether or not they like this or not, doesn't it just water that down? I guess it's a question of leave. I mean, isn't this going to make it harder to get to the simple majority?
My opinion is that particularly in an election where people are not overly loaded up with 47 amendments, the public's pretty smart. They can figure these things out. And some of that, I think, is dependent on how much work the legislature chooses to do in writing the ballot titles, which we have the prerogative to do, and has to be in a separate bill, which you have to have anyway for any of them. We've done that before. I've participated in prior sessions where we've done that, and how you state the questions, and for that matter, you could choose to write the voter's pamphlet as well. It's a legislative prerogative. Long answer to say, I think you can make it simple. Is there room for confusion? I suppose, but people will vote on both of them. It's a simple yes or no vote.
But we're
you know, we feel comfortable we can take this road and not mess it up in the end game.
Mr. Chair, we can't find anything in the Constitution that prohibits it. However, I should say...
You're going to get a new block in the chart here. That's what excites me. Yeah.
Well, it's not without risk because it hasn't been done before, and I'm certain that people could come up with creative arguments to challenge it. But we can't find anything explicit or any case that says that the legislature has to vote on them separately.
And you're under discussions with your counterparts across the street, and you want to slip this for a couple of days, what you're saying. And you're not trying to stiff me. Okay.
Well, I want to say something in relationship to Senator Brown's comments. Aside from, I'm not going to discuss here the issue of one bill, two bill, or two measures. There is this, the lawyer in the issue, that if we're going to file a serious legal challenge to term limits, serious legal challenge, to the extent we're even going to come up with a special piece of legislation to allow a quick opinion by the appellate courts on the constitutionality, which is, I understand, what the House is doing now, even though we don't have evidence of it. We don't have the evidence at the House floor.
Right.
I thought it, or it's tomorrow.
Yeah.
Right.
It's out of committee.
It's going to be voted, and it's going to move. There is a you call it expedited process, whatever the devil that means in terms of, and that was the question, the difficult question that was presented to the High Council, because it's very hard for anybody who knows about appellate courts to predict how quickly they'll move on anything. And there is some logic, significant logic, in saying that'll be our only shot this session at this thing. Our only shot. Don't muck it up by putting something on the ballot, because a court, if they have a way to get out of something, some courts, appellate courts, will use that to not to make a decision. To not make a decision. They will say, you know, they've got a ballot measure on there. This thing is so politically hot. Defer to let, you know, that kind of thing. There is some logic, a great deal of logic to that. So, I don't know. I got to tell you, I'd like to see what the House is really going to do on the expedited process, assuming it's a good faith attempt. And I'd like that bill to come here, I assume, Mr. Chair, of the expedited process, which then will put us all, put both issues before us, unless you decide to move this thing sooner or try to move it sooner. And then I guess we've got a tough decision to make. I'm serious.
Yeah.
Now, for those who just are opposed to term limits, just opposed to term limits, it's an easy vote. The good senator from all of Gresham and all of East County and all of Portland wishes to say something.
With the chair's permission. I have an almost sure way of guaranteeing the courts will address the issue quickly. And that is you allow the House bill and the Senate bill to go through, expedite the process for constitutional appeal of legislative term limits. Take this bill and you stuff it with term limits for judges. Let me send it up.
Now you can know far.
Yeah, now we've got another block that's going on here.
And then we'll get excited.
Right. Okay. So we're going to kick the can for another few days. You'll take this. Thank you, Ted. That was a very good job. We'll do it all when we get ready to do it. We'll close the work session. And does Mr. Allen wasn't with us last week.
He was not.
Everybody have all the details here?
Oh, I forgot.
Yeah, see there?
Cigars to give away.
And cigars.
Congratulations.
How big was this gift?
7 pounds, 11 ounces.
Whoa.
Maria Nadine Allen. She's a beautiful little girl.
Oh, fun.
And
surprise
C-section.
I was almost thinking
of...
What did
you say? Surprise C-section.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
And she looks exactly like her mother, which is a good thing for all of us.
The mother home.
Yeah. It was a work session, and we're adjourned.
She's home already.
She's going to have a home.
She's going to have a home delivery. Did you know that?